My name is Ashley Kahn. I'm a music historian, author, writer, journalist, and I work in various mediums, including written form, electronic, radio broadcast, etc.
Maybe you could start, just for context, by telling me, you know, your engagement with him later in his career, or middle part of his career.
Well, back in the late 80s, I was fortunate to be hired as a tour manager and on the road, you know, all-purpose guy to make sure that the tours went smoothly, all the productions went smoothly, for first Ladysmith Black Mambazo, the wonderful South African choir that Paul Simon discovered, you know, in his musical research behind before he put together Graceland. And then afterwards, when you know, they hit the cover of Rolling Stone and they won a Grammy for their first solo album here in the States, etc., etc., they're actually, they have yet to come down from that height. They continue to tour internationally. And that was sort of my entree into the Paul Simon experience of the mid to late 80s, when the Graceland glow basically put him back at the top of the charts and put him back on the road with an entourage of about 65 to 70 people, which included the musicians, the support crew, etc.
And since you were in the tour and sort of experiencing the appreciation, in a way, that people were showing for this music, what do you think, I mean, how is it plucking such a responsive chord for the public back then, do you think?
Well, I have my own theory of why Graceland and albums that were reaching for other sounds from other cultures suddenly became a sort of flavor of the day in the mid-80s. And that's simply because the other flavors that were being offered here in the States and, you know, within the pop and rock world had really become so formulaic and kind of dry and antiseptic. I mean, if you listen to the way that the technologies of the time, the synthesizers, the Linn drum, you know, was being integrated into the music, it was really kind of bloodless. I mean, there really wasn't much passion in that music. And I just remember, you know, not long ago reading an article that it was Vanity Fair's music issue, and they had gone to Elvis Costello to talk about his favorite 500 albums. And in the opening essay, he said, "You'll notice that there are not many albums from the 80s in my, you know, top 500." And that's because that was the decade music forgot. And I kind of ascribe to that feeling, too. I think that music just became very factory-like back then. And so when people like David Byrne, Peter Gabriel, Paul Simon were injecting strange, unusual sounds into their music, there was, you know, it's no surprise that that music went straight to the top, that people were so hungry for something different and something real. I mean, the horn lines, the guitar riffs on Graceland are unlike anything else that was happening back then. And also, if you have just a beginning knowledge of South African music, you'll know that in South Africa, there's such a panoply, such a range of musical styles and influences down there, and so much to choose from. It's not unlike Louisiana music, the way that New Orleans R&B and the Zydeco from the swamps and the Cajun music with the fiddles and accordions. There's such a wide range in that one very, very tight area, and the same with South Africa. And there's so much of the South African rainbow of sounds reflected in that album, and it's such joyous music that, you know, with the, of course, weight of Paul Simon's name and legacy, you know, it really did go to the top.
Mm-hmm. And with your experience with Paul Simon, did that cause you to sort of reflect back on his path in any more comprehensive way? Or what was your experience with his earlier phases?
Well, I think that, you know, looking back over Paul Simon's music, I mean, he has always been an integrationist. He's always been a musical detective, you know, the way that he used British folk music that goes back 200, 300 years on a tune like Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. You know, I mean, that's a British folk reel from about the 1500, 1600 period, you know, and he was able to take that to the top of the charts and also affect some anti-war sentiment into this ageless lyric. The way that he employed American gospel music, especially the quartet tradition on Loves Me Like a Rock. The way that he was one of the first rock and rollers on the American side to experiment with Jamaican reggae with Mother and Child Reunion. So he's always been in that way. He's always been in a big-eared way, we should say. So the fact that a carton of cassettes that were sent his way in the early 80s, filled with all these South African sounds, would you know, find fertile loam in his, you know, creative imagination. It had always been that way since the 60s.
Right. And whether it was, sort of deliberate or conscious or not, you know, it doesn't much matter, except that every time he does this, it somehow breaks through whatever else is, being offered for pop music at the time.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Paul Simon is a craftsman. He is someone who sees the studio as his main and primary area of creation. And that's where he would, you know, make it happen. It had been that way, I think, since The Sounds of Silence, when he, you know, was surprised to hear what, young engineer, Roy Haley, was able to do in adding, you know, a full string section and including a cannon burst, you know, on some of his songs of that era. And since that time, the studio is really where he, you know, made his magic happen. His tours tend to be replications as close as he can to what he's done in the studio. And yet, you know, the spirit of live music can't help but come through that. But that's really what Paul is about.
I know you said in your email that you were brought in toward the end of the Graceland experience, but is there a way to paint a picture of Paul Simon on stage in this context that, you know, you recall or like to recall about how he was presenting at that time?
Okay. Let me see if I can do that. Paul Simon, circa 1988 to 1991, was, you know, basically the lucky kid who gets to lead the circus parade. And he's got the elephants behind him, and he's got the giraffes, and he's got the trailers, and he's got the jugglers, and the clowns, and the strongman, etc. Except in this case, the musical equivalent of that is the Brazilian percussionist off of his left shoulder, the three pitch-perfect harmony singers from South Africa over his right. He has two drummers. He has three guitarists, a great bassist from the States. Great bassist from Soweto, Bagiti Kumalo. He had Ray Peary on guitar. He had, what's his name? He basically had picked and he had cherry-picked the best talent from all over Africa and mixed it in with Brazilian percussion and American session men like Michael Brecker, recently passed, on saxophone, Steve Gadd on drums. So he was cherry-picking not only from around the world, but from his past as well, because he had worked with Steve Gadd and Michael Brecker in the 70s to you know, great renown and great success. That was the type of experience it was. Everything else that happened, like this audiences going wild in Sweden, or in Moscow, or down in South Africa when he was finally able to tour take the music back home to South Africa in 1991. All of that was icing on the cake, because the cake was so well baked, you know?
Very good. Thank you for that, yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, good. Well, again, we could talk more, but if there, I'll give you sort of a last call on either of these topics. If there was something that you've been thinking about in the last few days that you just said, oh, yeah, I definitely want to get that in.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't talk about the specific songs on Graceland, but, you know, I mean, you know, I could just say that, you know, when he would hit the stage, and whether it was, you know, I mean, towards the end, of course, he was also integrating music from Rhythm of the Saints. And he would use that one tune from Rhythm of the Saints that opened with the sort of tribute to the doo-wop classic "Get a Job," you know, except, you know, the vocal line was played on this very on the lower end of an accordion, and the rest of the band would chunk in, you know. I mean, the crowds would go wild. The Obvious Child, that's the tune, you know, and what I think is overlooked in such a big way is that what is overlooked is the fact that Rhythm of the Saints really is an effective Graceland Part Two. And it just shows how, yes, I love South African music and Louisiana music, and isn't it interesting the connection between all of that? But there's a whole world beyond just those countries. Think of Brazil, think of, you know, all these other continents, you know, and we're standing on the shoreline fishing in a small inlet, and there's this vast ocean of musical possibilities out there. And I think that's really the message between those two albums.
Ashley Kahn, thanks for talking to me.
Happy to do it.
Yeah.